Let me start out by thanking everyone for coming to a noon talk and not running off to lunch. I certainly appreciate that. I know it took some willpower, maybe. This is some work that I did while a postdoc in Don Zak's lab at the University of Michigan. So I want to acknowledge that. I've since moved on to Kent State University. So I'm going to be talking about microbial responses to elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide. Oops, mouse working? Okay. But I wanted to start off just by giving a little bit of background. It's, I'm sure, no surprise to anyone in this room that atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide are rising and expected to rise for the rest of the century, and that when ecosystems are exposed to elevated carbon dioxide, one of the responses that is very typically seen is an increase in plant primary production, including in forests, forest ecosystems. This is a graph that was taken from a paper published earlier this year, which is just summarizing the consistent response of forest primary production across four different sites where the ecosystem has been exposed to elevated carbon dioxide. The site that I'm going to be talking about today is the Rhinelander, Wisconsin site. This is a aerial view of this this experiment, where in Wisconsin we have aspen dominated plantations which have been exposed to elevated carbon dioxide in these face rings. If you're familiar with the site, you know that there's also an elevated ozone treatment at that site, but I'm not going to be talking about that at all today. I'm talking about the responses to elevated carbon dioxide. Okay, so from the last slide, we know that at Rhinelander, in common with most other places, we've got elevated plant primary production. But what I'm interested in, what we wanted to start to look at, is the responses of the microbial communities to this increased plant production. And this is important for a couple of reasons, and probably a lot of different reasons that a lot of people in this room could tick off, including the fact that microorganisms will mediate the storage of carbon in these ecosystems, as well as nutrient turnover and the continued ability for the plants to have this elevated level of primary production. So those are the reasons we wanted to look at microorganisms. There had already been some background done at background work done at Rhinelander, and this is a publication from a graduate student in the Zak lab, which was showing, using biomarkers from PLFAs, from phospholipid fatty acid analysis, an increase in the relative abundance of fungi due to elevated carbon dioxide. And this result, this increase in fungal relative abundance, is similar to what's been found at a variety of other types of experiments in other systems. Some of those are listed here. And so this seems to be, while not universally detected, it seems to be a fairly general response to elevated carbon dioxide and increased plant production in these systems. Now, one of the typical sorts of explanations that's given for this data, for this response, is that with larger plants, they need to capture more nutrients, they have larger root systems, and so we have a response of mycorrhizal fungi to increase plant primary production at in the elevated CO2 plots. But what we were interested in, here we go, there's that arrow, what we were interested in is looking at saprotrophic fungi and trying to see if part of this response could be due to a disproportionate increase in the carbon captured by fungi, saprotrophic fungi, compared to bacteria. Okay, whoops, wrong way. So the major questions that my work addressed included the first one, just that, as I just stated, are saprotrophic fungi more competitive than bacteria under these conditions of elevated carbon dioxide and increased plant primary productivity? And we had some evidence that indicated that that was true from extracellular enzyme activities and incorporation of C13 compounds, similar to some of the other talk, you know, techniques similar to some of the other talks that we've heard this morning. But we wanted to try to establish an experimental system where we could isolate the responses of saprotrophs specifically. And then if they are more competitive under these conditions, basically the second question is, why do fungi have this advantage? Okay. So the primary hypothesis that we wanted to test here was that fungi have this ability to capture a disproportionate amount of the carbon in these systems due to two things. And those are their hyphal growth form, so that allows them to integrate environments or habitats of different qualities, as well as penetrate into habitats from edges. That coupled with the fact that this increased plant production produces increased plant litter that the saprotrophs feed on, and by nature this is a patchy resource for the microorganisms in soil. Okay, so that forms the basis of the growth form spatial hypothesis. There are a couple of alternative hypotheses that we also needed to keep track of, or because they may be important. One is that the elevated carbon dioxide was causing changes in plant litter quality or plant litter biochemistry, and that it was these changes in the plant tissue itself which was favoring the fungi. Now we had, again, there's some preliminary work or some other work at Rhinelander which had suggested that this would not be such an issue because the plant litter biochemistry wasn't changing that much under elevated CO2 in this system, but it was certainly a valid alternative hypothesis that we wanted to keep track of. So one of the experiments was designed to test that. And then the second alternative is basically like the null hypothesis for the growth form hypothesis, which is just that fungi have some sort of innate physiological advantage in exploiting plant tissue, such as more aggressive production of extracellular enzymes, which are involved in this decomposition process. Okay, so in order to test these hypotheses, we created a soil microcosm experiment and basically collected soil from ambient plots at Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and elevated CO2 plots, and brought those back to the University of Michigan, where we meticulously and painstakingly removed all of the root litter and shoot litter that we could with forceps from these soils. Even though I had sworn that I would never do an experiment like that again, because if you've ever tried it, you know how many hours that can take over for a large proportion of soil. So the solution was that we got a bunch of undergrads to help us. So the result was basically particle-free soil, or as near as we could get to particle-free soil, from both ambient and elevated CO2 plots, and then litter derived from elevated and ambient CO2 plots that was basically removed from the soil. And so then we could combine those in different combinations and different spatial arrangements to test those hypotheses that I outlined in the last slide. So these soil microcosms were performed, they were set up in soil cups basically, and incubated for either 23 or 56 days. I can go into more detail about the experimental design if anyone is interested. Let's see. First, I want to give you the test of that alternative hypothesis one. We basically, it was a fairly large microcosm experiment. There were a bunch of controls and other sorts of checks that we did along the way. Last night I cut the discussion of the vast majority of those because I didn't want to run out of time. I wanted to make sure that Shipping didn't have to stand up and boot me off the stage. But I did want to make sure that we got to this test of alternative hypothesis one. And so one of the treatments was to take ambient soil, particle-free ambient soil, and amend it with litter that was derived from the ambient plots and litter, and then other microcosms with litter derived from the elevated CO2 plots. And again, in this case, we're using PLFA biomarkers to try to trace the response of bacteria versus fungi in these microcosms. And so the short story for this test, this simple comparison of soil amended with either ambient litter or elevated CO2 litter, is that there were no significant differences in the PLFAs, which basically is another indication that plant biochemistry isn't playing much of a role in that increase in fungal relative abundance that we know is occurring in the field. Okay, so to get into more detail on this spatial hypothesis, we performed these other treatments that I'm going to discuss in more detail. So we had, the litter that we used to amend the particle-free soil, or the litter-free soil, and the litter was derived from elevated CO2 plots. And that's important because something that I haven't mentioned so far is that the CO2 fumigant at Rhinelander is basically labeled with a carbon 13 tracer. And so if we take litter from the elevated CO2 plots and add that to soil from the ambient plots, we're able to trace production of microbial biomass through this PLFA technique derived from the litter alone. And that becomes important in the next couple slides. So one thing that we were looking for was just we wanted to make sure that when we created these microcosms, we were simulating something relevant to what's going on in the field. And so two of the treatments were just taking litter particles and amending the soil with litter at two different rates, the rate that would be found due to primary production in the ambient plots in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and the rate that would be found in the elevated CO2 plots. And I want to make it clear that this isn't like a doubling or a tripling or anything of litter production. It's more like a 30% increase. Okay, I really have to speed up. The other hypotheses were tested by, basically the spatial hypothesis was tested by grinding the litter and amending the soil with a homogeneous distribution to try to remove any spatial effects, and then adding this ground litter in a patchy distribution to try to restore spatial effects but maintain the increased access points for microbial attack in the litter. All right, I'm going to skip this slide and look at fungal to bacterial ratio as measured by phospholipid fatty acid biomarkers and produced from litter. So we traced microbial biomass production using the C13 tracer into PLFAs. And what we saw, even with this relatively modest increase in litter from the ambient and intact particle amendment to that elevated CO2 level of amendment, we saw an increase in the fungal to bacterial ratio that was fairly dramatic, approximately a doubling. And then when we removed spatial effects by adding the litter, still at the elevated CO2 rate, but in this case, grinding the litter first, that increase in the fungal to bacterial ratio was essentially removed. There's a lot of variability. What I'm showing here is standard deviations, but there's quite a bit of variability in the data, but the decline here is almost back to the level of the ambient and intact treatment. So we think that this is pretty good evidence that this mechanism is playing a role. And then you can see that when we restored the patchy distribution, the fungal to bacterial ratio was again increased. All right, so I'll skip this slide. Come talk to me if you're interested. So just to wrap up, we've got some evidence that saprotrophic fungi, as opposed to mycorrhizal fungi, are better competitors in this under elevated CO2, and that in part this could be due to their growth form and the patchy distribution of plant inputs. This is a very general statement. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that this could be contributing to the lack of progressive end limitation and the sustained increase in plant production observed in many of these elevated CO2 experiments. And these were some of the assistants that helped out with picking litter and running PLFAs. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
Oh, you step, bro.
Okay, I'll ask a question.
Okay.
Just curious, did you see any detectable changes in soil pH due to elevated CO2 level?
In the field?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? I'm not sure. Don's in the audience, though. Are there any changes in pH at Rhinelander?
Yes.